across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. The homeless, I was talking about them last week. I was out with them last week. Now we learned that temporary accommodation couldn't stay open. And that, just the weekend there, when it was freezing cold. So why not? The housing executive saying it was a resourcing matter. How many people are going to be out in the cold? What are we going to do to help? I've already said, look, the 100 quid extra payment, I'm sure that'll be lots of the pensioners that they're getting, that 100 quid to mitigate against the winter fuel payment being lost. Those are for pensioners who have homes. What about the people who don't? And are we just going to not do enough until someone dies this month coming? All discussed on the Nolan Show this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Another week of Nolan Shows Then. And you know the email if you've got a story, nolan@bbc.co.uk. If you want to pick up the phone, no matter where you're from, no matter what you do for a living, no matter whether you work or not, I want you involved in the news. And you do that by contacting me here at the Nolan Show, 03030 80 55 55. So does the housing executive need to hang its head in shame this morning? After Paul McCusker, who's an independent councillor, says 15 people who asked for help on Saturday night, 15 homeless people, could not be provided with emergency accommodation. We knew this weather was coming. We knew we were in the midst of it. And we knew people would be asking for help. I wonder of those 15 people, how many of them came close to death. I wonder of those 15 people what it felt like to be out in the elements on Saturday night. The housing executives say they were extremely stretched. 4,500 households trying to avail of temporary accommodation. But what about these 15 people who were left out like what? A cat or a dog in the middle of the street? Because that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about that weather when some of us were cold inside, when some of us were pumping the heating up inside our homes to keep ourselves warm. 15 human beings were left on the street. And this is not just a question for the housing executive. This is a question for Stormont. What does the housing executive do if they don't have the resource? But the reality is, 15 people left out in the middle of that who were desperately asking for help. So this is not, as some homeless people do, choosing, saying, no, I don't want accommodation. This is people approaching the system saying, we desperately need a roof over our head. Let's speak to Paul McCusker this morning. Morning to you, Paul.
Morning, Stephen.
Of course, you've left the SCLP. I said SCLP. You're an independent councillor now. Talk us through this 15 number, where you've got it from and what your where happened.
Yes, Stephen. So during the bad weather all week, there was a temporary shelter open in Belfast. The freezing temperatures at the start of the week. And then as the week went on, that temporary shelter did stay open. On Saturday, the weather was still quite bad. We were dealing with floods. The People's Kitchen is a service that provides support to homeless people, and our service was extremely busy on Saturday night, and it was quite chaotic to try and find accommodation for people. And where we know 15 people that we know about that didn't get accommodation, we expect that figure to be a bit actually higher. The temporary shelter was closed on Saturday, and by 8:30 on Saturday night, we were told there was no beds left in Northern Ireland. Not one bed left at 8:30 on Saturday night.
So hold on. There was additional temporary accommodation opened last week, during the week. Is that right?
Yes, yeah.
And then on Saturday, when the weather got so bad, they closed it. Is that right?
Yeah. That's correct, yes. It was closed on Saturday, yeah. And as I say, people presented, and as you say, some people, don't want to maybe get a referral to accommodation, but 15 people that we work with, we're very eager to get indoors on Saturday night, and they were told by the housing sector there was nothing available.
So when you're talking about that temporary accommodation, when you said it was closed, like, was it closed with full up with people in it, or were the doors shut and there was nobody in it?
There was nobody in it, Stephen. We were told it was an issue around resource. you know, it worked really well throughout the week. And this homelessness and rough sleeping isn't just a problem when there's bad weather. You know, this accommodation is a serious issue. Every single day in Belfast, trying to find accommodation for people. And, you know, a number of weeks ago, you know, rough sleeping has trebled, and there was 47 people sleeping on the streets one night a couple of weeks ago. So rough sleeping is a major, major problem in Belfast. But when the bad weather comes, it brings added risks to people obviously sleeping rough. And we were very concerned on Saturday night that people, you know, were going to get a lot colder and potentially could die on our streets. So a lot of agencies were out providing sleeping bags, warm clothing, and trying to keep them safe on the streets.
What do you expect the housing executive to do? You're accusing them of failing the homeless. What do they do if they don't have the resources?
Well, it's not good enough, Stephen. I mean, and the thing is, you know, a lot of these people have legal status. So when you're accepted as homeless, they have a legal duty to provide accommodation. So they failed in their legal duty to provide accommodation. So that's one thing. I think the other thing in terms of obviously provision of temporary accommodation, I know that obviously the numbers have increased. The demand is very, very high. There's Christ beds, you know, that have been opened. There's different hostel provision that is provided across the city, but it's not enough. And, you know, when we see more people who sleep on the streets, more people at risk of rough sleeping, there has to be provision and a more better way of how we deal with this, because legally they're failing a lot of people.
Well, they're saying they're not. The housing executives say, we do not accept that we failed any legal duty to homeless presenters this week.
Well, those 15 people, Stephen, I can tell you, who presented to us on Saturday night, I can tell you most of them have legal status. Most of them have been accepted homeless by the Northern Housing Executive. So therefore, they have a duty to provide accommodation. And, you know, because when we ask the questions, we do referrals, the housing advisor is able to confirm if the person does have what you call FDA, which is a full duty applicant, and when you're accepted as homeless. So most people who we dealt with on Saturday night had that legal duty.
030 30 80 55 55. Imagine that weather over the weekend. Now imagine lying out in it. You know, one of the questions I've got for the housing executive this morning, and we'll go to them and we'll ask them this, is there anything to stop them, Paul? Maybe you know the answer to this. Is there anything to stop them in extreme weather like we had, buying a hotel room for these people?
There is. I mean, at times they do use, I mean, every month they spend over £1 million every month on hotel and B&Bs to put people into a temporary accommodation. So there is that availability in terms of actually using hotel accommodation, but I don't know why they didn't use that at the weekend. But I mean, that they do provide, it's called non-standard accommodation, and they provide hotel and B&Bs at times when the demand is very high.
So did you meet some of these homeless people that couldn't get somewhere over the weekend?
The 15 people that presented to us, Stephen, we were engaged with them on Saturday night, and a lot of them were left frightened. A lot of them were left on the street, and they didn't know, you know, what was going to happen that night. And outreach groups, you know, the Welcome Organisation was doing outreach, our team were doing outreach, other services like Teen Challenge were doing their drop-in. So the support sort of workers in terms of different agencies were responding the best they could. But those 15 people who we dealt with were left frightened and you know, on the streets, and we've done it the best we could.
So we have a number of questions here, don't we? One, that temporary accommodation, how come we've got to the stage where we couldn't keep it open? It was open Monday to Friday, but not at the weekend. What happened? Can housing executive staff not be called in emergency situations? What type of staff would it have needed to keep that temporary accommodation open? Why, at the very heart of this dangerous period for these homeless people, were they left out on the street? Why? And then, when the housing executive knew that these human beings were going to be in that cold weather, why didn't they book hotel rooms for them? What are the rules around that? And there are lots of rules about qualifying for being legally homeless. I can see it in front of me here. But you're telling me, Paul, that some of those people had already been designated as having legal status as being homeless.
Absolutely, Stephen. Most of them did. Actually, you know, most of them are well known to homeless services. And out of the 15 people, I'd say that the vast majority of them did have legal status, yeah.
Over the weekend, say the housing executive, over 4,500 households availed of temporary accommodation. Well, of that 4,500 figure, of course, the majority of those maybe were people that, were in the system getting temporary accommodation before this cold spell hit. So just how much urgent, unexpected demand was there on the housing executive at the weekend? Just how much? We need to find out that as well. The human effect on these people, Paul, what were they left like at the weekend?
As I say, Stephen, a lot of them were left frightened, cold, not sure, you know, and some actually went to the NE department to take shelter at the Mater Hospital and the Royal Hospital. And, you know, a lot of them were supporting each other as well. We provided warm clothing, sleeping bags, some food as well. But, you know, most of them were quite frightened, not knowing what the night was going to bring for them. And we advised them then to engage on Sunday with the Hound Executive to see if things did change. But it's a massive impact for anybody sleeping on the streets, Stephen. You know, the physical impact and the mental health then deteriorates. You know, we have issues with addiction. And that can spiral out of control very quickly because of the situation that they're in. And quite often a lot of them are caught in that cycle of addiction, cycle of homelessness, and quite often, you know, can't get out of it. And that's the worrying thing for me, is that the longer a person stays on the street, the more risk of death and more risk of them caught up in that cycle of addiction and poor mental health.
I can see the housing executive here saying that immense pressure was placed on them because of the situation, unprecedented, record-breaking levels of people presenting for emergency temporary accommodation. This was a result of the flood conditions being experienced across Northern Ireland. We know that 76 people presented themselves to the out-of-hours service on Saturday night. That figure would normally be around 20. So 76, over threefold. But four of those, were because of the flooding. Those are the figures that we understand. So was our housing executive effective enough, worried about human safety enough to the extent that people were scrambling to sort these people, to get them a roof over their head somehow? And I'm still intrigued with this temporary accommodation. You know, Tesco's can keep Tesco's open in the bad weather. The BBC can function in the bad weather. Why did that temporary accommodation close down? Why? Why? Andy, good morning, Andy.
Morning, Stephen.
Morning. You were on Nolan Live with me, Andy. You've been homeless yourself. You know what it feels like to be out in that. What would it have been like? Put words to what it would have been like for these people out in that on Saturday night.
Oh, that would have been a night not to be out in it. That weather was just shocking. The rain. I'd say any departments would have been bummed with people going up with depression, people taking overdoses just to try and get off the streets for the night. So I know what it's like. I've been there. It's just not a place to be anymore. It's hateful. You can't get nowhere to stay. And then how exactly to tell you, oh, we'll phone back about an hour's time. And then when you phone back, there's like no changes in your circumstances. And lads, you're left on the streets with your own self to survive. No sleep, no nothing. Just drugs was the only way when you were on the street.
And you're telling me that people would have taken overdoses to get through the weekend?
Yeah. Actually, I walked by a few people there on Sunday, and they were in a bad condition. I felt sorry for them. If I had anything, I would have given it to them, but I didn't have anything. And as I say, it's the ones I feel sorry for. It's because the housing executive aren't pulling their fingers out of their backside and doing more for the homeless people.
Can you put words to what happens to the human body when you're in that state of cold and bad weather? What happens?
Your mental health deteriorates, and your pound on the drugs that you take to try and get you through that night until the morning time, until you knew you were safe. Because, like as I say, on the streets, you can't sleep. You're being robbed. Things are being taken off you. It's just an awful, awful place. Like it opened up, I'm sure, a hostel somewhere down in Belfast near the docks, a new building or something for homeless people to go to keep them off the streets.
But do we, look, I want to hear from the housing executive today. It would be great to hear from someone from that organisation. Because I don't think there's anybody believes that the housing executive, the good staff, the good management team in the housing executive doesn't want to help people. So we need to understand what is going on here. It'll be a complex situation. And by the way, it's not just the housing executive. The churches throughout Northern Ireland, what were they doing this weekend? What were they doing? Were they opening up their doors over the weekend or were they bolted shut? All of these churches throughout Northern Ireland whose message is one of charity and we help each other. Did any of those churches feel and the leaders of the churches feel how cold it was and how they might be able to actually help people? And then it goes to all of us in society as we're walking past homeless people and we know how cold they are. We know how dangerous this situation is. All of the empty buildings throughout Northern Ireland. Publicly owned, empty buildings. What are we doing? Has anybody in Stormont, does anybody that is an elected representative, or any of them thinking, well, this is an opportunity to show that I'm going to use our collective power in the right way? I said this on Friday. I looked into the eyes of some of these people last week. I had my hat on, my gloves on, my fat belly on, my big thick coat on, the luxury of being out there for about an hour, 2 hours, whatever it was, and then getting into a car and putting the heater on. And I saw the terror in the eyes of some of these people. Absolute sheer terror, Andy, of how they were going to get through the night.
Well, seeing as I say, man, it's a hard thing to do because when you're trying to survive, there's no sleep in your head and there's no security around you. And as I say, drugs are the only answer. And by that way, it's highly exaggerated, as you say, and as I said to you, they do need to get their finger out of their backside and start helping the homeless people and stop helping the foreign people and help our people and our society who needs the houses more important than bringing in foreign national people, if you know what I mean. I'm not being a racist here, Stephen, but it is true.
But why can't we help? Why can't we help both? And why can't we just look at people as human beings in the cold, rather than distinguishing between a foreign national person who is freezing, who's close to death from freezing, who is starving, who's pumping themselves with drugs in order to get through the cold at the weekend, and someone that was born here, Andy? Why do we need to distinguish? We're talking here about human beings freezing in sub-zero temperatures. That's what we're talking about.
It's only that there too, Stephen. It's the two of Stormont as well. Stormont need to get themselves sorted out and stop getting on like wee kindergartens, if you know what I mean, as well. And to sort the housing problems out as well. That all needs to come from Stormont. But as I say, we're not being run by Stormont. We're being run by England's government. We don't have a say in this country, man. I said this, as I tell you the last time. We don't have a say. Only place we have a say now is America.
All right, Andy, thank you. 030-30-80-55-55. Mark in Belfast. Morning, Mark.
Morning, Stephen. Thanks for having me on. It really strikes me, so it does, about how bad it was at the weekend. You know, I'm worried about my trampoline and my kids' trampoline blown away, but yet 15 people are worried about their lives. I think it's ridiculous.
And by the way, the 15 people is just the 15 that Paul McCusker, the independent councillor, interacted with, knew about. It's going to be more. It's going to be a lot more than 15 people, Mark.
Yeah, and I think whenever I look at it, like, there's buildings in Belfast which are being given free to people in the arts. And I understand that the arts are there to help with mental health and lots of other stuff. But we need to prioritise and prioritise lives. You know, I understand, like, what that guy was saying there. Like, I got up this morning. I suffer from depression and anxiety. I got up this morning. I'll be honest with you. I didn't want to get up out of bed. I'm in a bad way mentally, so I am this time of year. But I have a house to go to. I have a family. Now, yes, if I didn't have my family, I don't know what state I'd be in. But if I was on the streets, I don't think I would be here. Yes, I would probably turn to the lifestyle that these people have no choice but to turn to. And it's heartbreaking. So it is. And some of these people will show up at a hostels absolutely out of their head and stuff, that they have no choice. In order to get through the day, they have to do this. And then they're being turned away. We need to have hostels in place to help people. We need to have rehab in place to help people. We need, as a society, everyone to help. Now, you're saying about the churches. The church that I go to, see, this time of year, they open every single day for people that are homeless.
What about overnight?
For people, yeah, but overnight, the thing with the overnight thing is, there's people there. If you were to go, say, me or you were homeless, and we went to that church, and we saved you near the home, you'd have a bed that night. Because there's people in there that do it. Not every church does that, and I admit that. But some do. The problem is the church that I go to is in Finnegate. It's not in the city centre. But they're involved with outreach that do work in the city centre.
There are so many, and I touched on some of this last week. If you think about it, think about the news cycle over the last week. Stormont, you know, presenting a story that they are helping pensioners who have homes with £100 winter fuel allowance help, given the fact that the 300 odd quid was withdrawn. Stormont here in Northern Ireland is saying, okay, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to help pensioners with roofs over their heads. We're going to give them 100 quid. Now, look, fair enough. That's for all you to decide whether that's a good use of money or not. But handing 100 quid to people who have houses, where's the 100 quid per homeless person? Where's the extra investment from this executive to people lying on concrete, freezing concrete over the weekend? Where is it?
There's also, where's the help to get these people to get a job? You see the adverts. I've seen the advert on TV. I don't know what bank it is doing it, but they're advertising this about this endless circle. You don't have a home, so you can't get a bank account. You can't get a job because you don't have a bank account.
Short term. Look, that's long term or medium term. And look, it's a valid discussion again, Mark. What I'm representing this morning is short term. Is in the month of December, you know, some of our political leaders stand up now and tell us that they're interested in bread and butter issues. Where is the imminent help for these people who are being terrorised by the weather? Terrorised by it.
Well,
if anybody's walking along Belfast city centre, anywhere else, get yourself out and look at these people in the eye. They are in big trouble. Massive trouble. And this temporary accommodation, Mark, like, I keep on looking at this. Temporary accommodation, because of the extreme weather, was open and it closed on one of the most extreme nights on Saturday. Is there anyone within the housing executive thinking to themselves how that looks? It closed on the coldest night.
You look at the big building, right? Okay, now I'm going by what I may not be 100% right here, but there's a big arts building in Belfast called The Vault, right? Does some great stuff for kids and lots of different things. As far as I know, that's right beside the Albert Clock, right in the heart of our city centre.
What is?
The building. It's called The Vault. It's an art studio. It's about 3 or 4 stories tall. They get that free. Why isn't that used for homeless shelter? That's massive. Now, obviously, if you own a building and nobody's in it, you have to pay rates. But if you give it to charity, your rate's exempt. So why doesn't the government do an incentive to these building owners, not to give them away rates exempt, but to make money, to rent them off at a certain subsidy?
It's not just about opening a building. You need staff in the building, don't you?
Exactly.
For it to be safe.
Why are we using money for that? Why aren't we taking money out of other things? Like, you could get into the argument that we spend so much money on our cross-community stuff here, which is ridiculous, and I'm not going down that avenue, but we do waste money in this country. This country costs more money to run per person than anywhere else in the UK, and that's down to our troubled past. But if we were to be smart and to try and put that behind us and to try and move forward and free up money, we would be able to look after these people. We'd be able to give them accommodation. We'd be able to help them in regards to their addictions, get them jobs, and help them out of this hole that they're in.
I'm just looking at this statement from the housing executive. It doesn't tell us how many people approach them for urgent emergency help at the weekend. It just doesn't. Their statement says over the weekend, over 4,500 households availed of temporary accommodation. You see, that's not pinpointed to, because of the extreme weather, how many approached them. We know 76 people approached the housing executive. We think that 4 of that 76 was because of the flooding. Housing executive saying the flooding conditions presented them with unprecedented and record-breaking levels of demand. Will that temporary accommodation that shut at the weekend, will it be open next weekend? Is it open today? What was the reason it shut? Because of resources. Well, what does that mean? It means people, does it? Does it also mean money? And by the way, when I'm questioning what Stormont's going to do, what the housing executive's doing, what about us? What are we doing? Somebody's going to die in the middle of this. And maybe more than one. While we turn the radiators up. Michael in Newton Abbey. Good morning, Michael.
How you doing, Steve?
Go ahead.
No, just a wee idea. I'm going to do this this Christmas time. I've got a wee bit of a front gardener, a bit of grassy front garden. It's going to open it up, and I'm going to allow maybe a homeless person to put up a wee tent over Christmas, and over Christmas Day I'll be able to give them a bit of food and a bit of drink, and you know, somewhere safe to stay, and then maybe after a few days they can move on. So it's just a so I'm thinking about getting a wee social media and maybe a wee website to sort of promote the idea so other people can do it too.
Well, after a few days, Michael, you've got someone homeless, a stranger, in your garden, and they don't move on. Are you going to take that risk?
Well, this is the risk, but I have family who work in the sector that looks after homeless people, so I know a few people personally that could maybe use the facilities, and I could have reasonable trust in the people that I can open it up to. But yes, there is that risk, Stephen, but I think it's a risk worth taking.
Is this really hitting you this morning, Michael? Is that why you've called me? Is this resonating with you?
Well, I think it resonates for everybody, Stephen. Some of them. I mean, I can't walk past a person who's begging the street. If I'm in the city centre, I'm out for a few drinks, and I see somebody, and you can clearly see they're struggling. You can maybe see the lack of sleep and the pale skin and the dirty clothes. And you know, I find it hard to actually walk past something like that. Maybe not. You know, give them a cigarette, give them some money, or just buy them a McDonald's or whatever it may be. Just absolutely.
Michael, thank you. Let's pause there. There's so many calling us about this, and there's so many questions around it. 03030 80 55 55. We'll pause there. Let's get the news from the BBC. Norma, good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. My goodness, I'm just looking at the screen here, just getting the notes for your story. I know you've called us this morning.
Yeah.
My goodness. Tell me about your 9-month-old little baby.
Well, it's my wee grandson. It's my daughter's wee son. We were babysitting on Friday evening, and my daughter phoned me on Saturday morning and said, "Oh my God, Mummy, the whole house is flooded. The house is completely flooded."
So where does she live?
She lives in Park Avenue. Well, she did until Saturday.
Where's that?
Park Avenue, Dundonald.
Aye, Dundonald.
Yes, just off the Cumber Road.
I drive down it every day.
Yep, she lives just off Park Avenue, or just on Park Avenue there.
So what happened?
We went on. It was horrendous, Stephen. She showed me a video of from up her stairs. Her hall was completely flooded. The water was two stairs deep, you know, two steps high, and the whole ground floor is completely underwater. She has lost everything. Everything. She's lost everything. The washing machine, the fridge, the baby's toys, the cooker, everything. Clothes, shoes, the whole lot. It was above the plug sockets, so anything electrical is completely gone. She literally has nothing other than pretty much what she's wearing and what they were able to salvage from upstairs.
Was it your daughter on Good Morning Ulster this morning?
No, she wasn't on this morning. No, she was on...
Is she sitting beside you?
No, she's actually gone back up to her home again because to see if there's anything that can salvage. I think the landlord is coming up today. But she phoned the housing executive this morning and they said, we'll get in touch with you within a week. Within a week.
So she's nowhere to live?
No, she's homeless. She can't go back to that home, especially with a nine-month-old baby. And Stephen, there's way, way more than 25 people homeless. In her street alone, there's 25 houses. So each house has pretty much got a family in it. So I'm not too sure how many people, but they're all homeless. None of them can live in their homes. They're uninhabitable now.
And has this happened before on that street?
Many years ago, yes. Now, there was a whole infrastructure put in place to help with any flooding there because there is a small river, excuse me. But on Saturday morning there, it didn't make any difference. The water was like a foot and a half above her front door.
So all that water right throughout the ground floor, wrecking everything?
Everything's destroyed. She has nothing left. Nothing.
And then, of course, if she goes to apply for insurance in the future again, next year's premium's going to be through the roof if she can get insured at all.
Exactly, yes. And it said that she, if she wants to go back to that, it was a private rental. Sorry, my voice was going this morning. If she wants to go back to that house, it could be at least 6 to 9 months, maybe. But effectively, she's homeless. She's got nowhere to go.
Well, she's staying with you.
Well, she's staying with me, yes. I will never see her out, but the housing executive have been of very little help, to be quite truthful with you. They have just said, call us back in a week. You know, now, what good is that to anyone?
They must have contingency plans. They must have.
You would think so. I would hope so. But, I mean, I understand there's lots and lots of people out there that are looking for accommodation also, but you think a wee baby would kind of go up the list a wee bit, would you not?
Would you do me a favour? I'll let you speak to the team behind the scenes here.
And we'll
see if we can get your daughter to talk to us this morning as well. So I'll say good morning to you, Norma. Thank you. Stay on the line. We'll talk to you behind the scenes. Jane and Temple Patrick. Morning, Jane.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, I think this is not as a job for the Stormont. We were told before we went back into government, oh, let us all have our own government and everything will be hunky-dory. What have they done in a situation like that? Saturday evening, you wouldn't have put a dog out on the street, never mind a human being. I mean, what have you spoken to anybody that could do anything? Are they just words? And what Michelle O'Neill says, Pengelly just parrots the same thing off again, all for photos, as long as they can be seen. We want to see them doing something. We don't want to see their mug shots on the television and in the papers.
Well, I think that is a fair question of the First and Deputy First Minister. They are the symbolic and real. It's both, you know. Heads of this country, the First and Deputy First Minister says it all. So to you, Michelle O'Neill, to you, Emma Little Pengelly, for those people, those human beings lying on freezing concrete on the streets, what is your initiative?
Nothing, and we know it.
Well, can
you? It's all talk. It's only a talking job
up
there.
Let's give them a chance. Let's give them a chance.
You've had a chance. What do you want them to do? Do you want more people to be dead? I mean, you were talking about your nice... Well, all thankfully, I have a nice, comfortable home. But you have to think on the ones who are not so fortunate. A human being, flesh and blood, out on the street.
Well, let's start to think of some of the practical things, because there's no point having a pop at Michelle and Emma Little Pengelly.
Well, that's what she's there for. She's supposed to be in control. If she can't do the job...
Let's just go through what could they, short-term, imminently do. Could there be an emergency plan to get more sleeping bags, to get more warm clothing to our homeless in the community? Could Stormont coordinate that? Could there be some type of message? And I'm asking this openly. And some of you will have ideas, no doubt. 03030 80 55 55. So could there be, this is a local government for local people, could there be an emergency plan to get warm, hot food and clothing to these people? Could there be any gesture from Stormont in terms of hotel accommodation and on the freezing nights? How complicated is that? Do you set a precedent that they won't be able to then sustain? I don't know the rules around that. I don't know the dangers around that. But surely to goodness, we should all be thinking, how do we help human beings on cold concrete trying to stay alive in this weather, Jane?
Yes, that's what I'm... Stormont, what have they done? They've done nothing. You keep saying give them time. A much longer time. People are going to die on the streets. There's a mother, a granny on there talking about her wee baby. I think it's so many months old. I mean, it's unprecedented. And they must have... The government, if they're worth their name, if they're worth their salt, they should be doing something. But they'll come on and they'll say nice words. We don't need words. We need actions.
Well, there was 20 million, that monitoring round that you heard us talking about last week. That's essentially, look, if there's cash up there in Stormont that they divvy it out, right, across the departments. And there was £20 million given to the Department for Communities for new build social housing and £10 million towards discretionary support and the Supporting People programme, as well as for homelessness interventions. So Gordon Lyons was given some money. His department was given some money.
He took a skate off it. Was it five of them went over to America and swarmed around? That cost a bag of money.
Well, Gordon Lyons...
You have to face reality.
Gordon Lyons would say he wasn't swanning around. He was trying to bring investment back to Northern Ireland.
Well, has he done anything? I mean, does it take five people to ask? I mean, surely three at the very most. They're on a jolly, and anybody knows that.
Well, he would completely deny that. Absolutely, categorically. Categorically deny that, Jane. And that's just not fair. It's just not fair at all. Gordon set out actually on this program last week the different people that he met up with in order to try to attract business back into this country. Does anybody know of any church in Northern Ireland? And I'm sure there were some that opened up their doors on Saturday or Sunday night. Did anybody? Maybe you can call me 03030 80 55 55, and we'll stay across this conversation. I would like more detail out of the housing executive as to the specifics as to why that temporary accommodation closed down and what we're going to be doing in December. What are we going to do to keep as many people, homeless people, alive as possible? Now, as you can hear this morning, you are a big part of this programme. You know, our SIG tunes, everything says it. You drive the news agenda on this programme. And you do that by emailing us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. We love getting stories from you because we can make those powerful stories and we can knock on a lot of doors to get you answers. James sent his story into that email, nolan@bbc.co.uk. He contacted me about his 89-year-old mum, who has dementia, recently had a fall, and the family have had issues with their home care since. James began by telling me about his mum.
So basically, Stephen, she had a fall on the Saturday, the 2nd of November, resulting on a fracture of her leg, fracture to what the medics call a T12, which is the bottom of the spine. And so basically she was getting treated in the hospital for it, and whenever come the stage, we were getting her released on the Tuesday, the 5th of November. But little did we realise at the time, Stephen, that we from, you know, in hindsight, a great, great thing, so it is, you know what I mean? The information, the good information we had been given, really, for the mummy's injury, mummy should really have been put into rehabilitation first, and then a bed, hospital bed and stuff put in place at home here for coming back out home again here.
Okay, so okay. He got her home eventually, right?
Yeah, we got her home on the Tuesday, so we did. But it wasn't until we had got her home, Stephen, that we realised, you know, we should have had a bed. She should have been in rehabilitation. We should have had a bed and place here for her coming home after probably the rehabilitation. And basically, myself and my wife, we just felt like, you know, I know the health services is struggling too, Stephen. I'm not here to put my boot in the health service because I was a firefighter myself for 33 years and I understand the strains of it with waiting, being at road traffic collisions, you know, waiting ambulances coming delayed, arrivals of ambulances, stuff through no fault of the ambulance service either, you know, so I do get that, you know, but the bottom line is I just need to fight my mum's corner here. And basically she come whenever we got home, it was then we realised we should have had a bed in place here. And obviously we felt we weren't getting proper information in the hospital prior to my mum's release.
And so how many days was your mum back home without a bed?
She was back home. She would be back home. She came back out on the 5th of November, Stephen. So up until yesterday, yesterday the 21st, I think. Up until yesterday, to about 5:10, the bed arrived. So the guys arrived and installed the bed and set it up. My wife, she was here on her own. I was working myself yesterday, and my wife was here to help them to get in and set the bed up. But
and you feel obviously you'd contacted us about your mum not having a bed.
Absolutely.
And we got in touch with the trust on your behalf.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the bed was delivered the next day, is that right?
Stephen, the crux of it is I can't, you know, myself and my wife were physically, emotionally and mentally nearly drained, so we are, you know what I mean? But because basically we're mum's carers until such place we get the care plan up and running properly for mum. But see, without the help of yourselves or yourself and your researchers or Tommy and stuff, I've been pillared from pillar to post, so I have, you know what I mean? And the stress of it has been unreal. And basically from I was speaking to Tommy, your researcher, on Wednesday afternoon, probably I would say between phone calls and the last phone call I got was from a guy from the trust, I would say you were probably looking about maybe 3 and a bit hours, Steve, we had a bed. Which was amazing. We couldn't believe it. There was tears, and myself and my wife sat and cried here. So we did because of the stress. We were just, you know, we couldn't believe it, Stephen. So from that fact, the Nolan Show, hey, if we're to tell you, the power of media is unbelievable, Stephen. So it is.
Well, just remember, you pay for it. So you pay for it through a license fee. I keep telling people that this is what a BBC license fee buys you. It empowers you to speak truth to power. It empowers you to hold them accountable and to have your rights. It helps empower you. And look, I'm glad that happened. But you have further questions to ask here about what's going on and what else you need. And this is around a care package now. Talk to me about this. Yeah.
So basically, Stephen, Mum, we're very lucky. We've got a care package from the trust, morning and lunchtime, and then there's a different company comes in at night time there's a girl comes in at night time to put Mum to bed. Now they're called singles, which obviously a girl comes in because of the care package we have as a single, which was working fine until Mum had the fall. And basically they were able to come in, they were able to wash her, get her showered twice a week, get her dressed, get her out of bed and everything, Stephen, you know what I mean? And then from the fall, the single team, through no fault of theirs, because of the powers that be, their protocol is that all they can do is wash Mummy's face and hands. They can't even take her out of bed, you know what I mean? So myself and my wife, we have been the ones who have been getting her out of bed morning. And every morning you're waking up, Stephen, you're there knocking your stomach, thinking, here we go. Now, I don't mean this against my mum because I love her a bit, but you had her knocking your stomach because of the stress of going on to get Mummy out of bed with the pain, you know? But basically, since the bed come, we had a double team coming in now, but we were told last night that they can't do anything for us until the risk assessment is done to the bed. Having said that, this morning, the double team came in this morning, and they were able, because the hospital bed's in place here, they were able to actually wash Mummy in the bed. Now, they still, even though they're double-faced, aren't able to, through no fault of theirs, they're not able to get Mum out of bed. Again, we have to get Mum out of bed and go through this process of getting her out of bed and putting her to bed at night again until this risk assessment is complete, Stephen.
And so when will the risk assessment be done?
Well, funny you should say there, Stephen. The social worker just rang me really a couple of minutes before you rang her. And to be honest with you, I told them we'll call them back again. So basically, I said to them, look, I says, we need this risk assessment done 2 weeks ago, if you know what I mean. And he says, look, he says, all I can do is chase this up, he says, and try to get this risk assessment done. Now, I didn't get a chance to ask him when, Stephen, but the stress and the mental and emotional and physical stress, myself and my wife have been through this past nearly 3 weeks now. You know, another week of this would be totally on, would break us, Stephen, to be honest with you, and that's not a sob story. It's truth that it's ready to break us, so that, you know what I mean? So we feel that because we've been let down by the Northern Trust, i.e. hospital, and maybe the social workers in the hospital, I don't know, but we feel we have been let down for the simple fact that we weren't given proper information before Mummy was discharged from the hospital, and we were left in limbo to basically care for Mummy ourselves, even though we had a single care package in place, which, as I say, we now have a double in place, Stephen, and we're just sitting here just... Well, yes, they were able to wash Mummy this morning, babe, which was good. The wee woman hasn't even had her hair washed in 3 weeks, Stephen. You know what I mean? That's soul destroying.
And have they part of this is about communication. Have the Northern Trust communicated with you when this risk assessment is likely to be done?
We don't know. We don't know, Stephen. Now, having said that, our home social, the girl that's our social worker at home here, obviously she's separate from the hospital, Stephen. We couldn't ask for a better, her hands are tied too. We couldn't ask for a better girl to be on board with. She's pulled out strings left, pulled out stops left, right and centre for us and different things in the past. She's absolutely unbelievable. We've been absolutely snookered without her, Stephen, for a start, you know what I mean? So that's one thing I'm going to sing her praises for that, because she's been absolutely amazing for us. We would have been broke before now, Stephen, only for her, you know what I mean? But again, you know, how long is a piece of string, Stephen? I don't know yet. I'm hoping that the social worker can come back to me and say, look, we can get a risk assessment done today, or maybe at the very latest, because it's coming up the weekend, we'd be happy for a risk assessment done on the Monday, and we could go through the process the weekend to help Mummy out of the bed, stressful as it is, but we could do that if we knew we had an end result, Stephen, something to look forward to, that we know that the pressure's going to be taken off us, you know what I mean? That's where we are.
So what the Northern Trust are saying is options available to families were discussed with you. In recognition of the changing needs, they said that, look, the Trust is committed to packages of care on review. So what have they offered you? A temporary stay in a care home setting were discussed, says the Northern Trust, as an option?
I think it might have been mentioned, Steve, honestly, because our brains are fried. It might have been mentioned in fairness to them, I don't know. But where we are at this current situation, Stephen, we're sitting here, yes, with the bed. Such a relief to get the bed. We thought, happy days, that's it. Pressure's off now because the doubles are going to be coming in 4 times a day. And then it's got the stage now where the stress level is starting to build up again last night. Whenever I got home from work last night, I drive a lorry a couple of days a week. I was a firefighter for 33 years, as I said to you. And whenever I got home last night, my wife, she was stressed. When we worry that I'm trying not to show her this, you know, I mean, you're trying to be strong for her, but at the same time, we've gone through a hell of a lot in the last nearly 3 weeks, Stephen, and we just need something to come to, you know, to a completion here, just for our sanity and for my mum's well-being, which she deserves.
I can hear you're at your wit's end and you're fighting.
Absolutely.
So be specific for me. Mm-hmm. What do you need the Northern Trust to do specifically? What is your ask?
Basically, get our risk assessment done ASAP, that we can get on with our lives and be more chilled and be able to look after Mummy in the interim of the carers coming in 4 times a day, Stephen, where it makes our lives, takes the pressure off us.
Okay.
And basically, that's it in a nutshell, you know what I mean?
What we will do is we will go to the Northern Trust. We will focus this on the risk assessment. We will ask them when it's going to be done. and we will try to come back to you as soon as possible. Is that all right?
Yeah. We're lucky. Myself and my wife, we live with my mum here. So we're lucky that we're able to be here. And it, you know, sometimes it is frustrating and it, you know, it can be hard work at times. In fact, it is hard work, actually. But, hey, that's my mum. My mum reared us. My mum reared myself and my brother. She lost a wee sister, my daughter, as I say. But she reared us, staying on this time. It's payback time to look after her. And whenever you're not being given the resources, even, you know, from a sidekick and from a package, you know, the care package thing, just that we can still look after mummy too. You know, the thing is, we are lucky we have a voice for mummy. There's poor critters out there, Stephen, who just have no voice, and God love them. You know, there's people, maybe the only people they maybe see in a day is maybe carers coming in, and that, you know, must be heart-wrenching for people too, you know what I mean? So it's not all about us. We're not the only ones, and I understand there's probably people worse off than us, but I have to fight. I can only fight our corner, Stephen. That's the thing, you know what I mean?
Jim, leave this with us, and thanks for talking to us today.
Stephen, listen, you're a gentleman. Thank you very much, and thank you to your team again, because you have done so much at the minute there, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, we recorded that just a few days ago, and as promised, we worked on that story. James is back with us. Morning to you.
Morning. Fantastic team.
Good morning. And so you've now got your risk assessment done.
Everything's done in place, Stephen, on Friday. I'm actually just a wee bit emotional just Stephen, listening to that playback there. But bear with me. I'm a sort of a soft critter. Basically, Stephen, within probably an hour of probably being speaking to yourself on Friday morning, we got a phone call to say a district nurse was arriving. So cut a long story short, district nurse, who was absolutely lovely girl, arrived on Friday afternoon, done the risk assessment, and we had all the people walking on place by about 4:45, which meant that we had the double care team coming in the evening time to do what we've been waiting for the past 3 weeks, through no fault of theirs, Stephen.
Well, that's fantastic. That is absolutely fantastic. So that's a result for you, James.
Absolutely, Stephen, 100%. And Stephen, just a little
more importantly, a result for your mum. More important.
Absolutely, 100%. That's the bottom line, Stephen. You know what I mean? And, you know, hopefully, you know, we, myself, my wife, family, you know, hopefully this is going to highlight things for other people. At the power of media, yes, you told me on Friday that, you know, yes, we pay for our license stuff. Absolutely. But at the same time, you took that on board for us from a personal level, Stephen, as you do with everybody else. And, you know, without that there, we probably wouldn't even be anywhere near. We probably wouldn't have a bed even at this stage, Stephen. You know what I mean? So, we just can't thank you enough. And you know what? I want to say to the people that's listening there too, don't be shy. There's help there, you know what I mean? Whether it be yourselves or newspapers or whatever, you know what I mean? The help's there. Please use it. You know, and we're not the type of people ourselves who, you know, we're not troublemakers ourselves, Stephen, but we're people of principle, and we've fought a fight for our mum. We've won the fight, and I just wish and hope that other people take that on board too, that, you know, help, sir. Just keep pushing, because as I said to you on Friday, Stephen, there's people worse off than us, but when it's on your own doorstep, it doesn't come any worse.
There's a, I don't want to get too slushy about this, because people think I'm up to something that I'm not.
No, no.
But there's a, there is an embryonic, or whatever the big word is. I don't know. What is that big word? I don't know what the word is. But anyway, there's a very, very close relationship. Okay, between BBC Northern Ireland and someone like yourself, and it's as simple as this. Symbiotic, I'm being told. It's as simple as this. If you don't come for us for help, we can't help you. When you see that big brick building outside Ormoe Avenue with a BBC on it, that building means nothing. It's about the relationship between you and people like me and the BBC. So, James, thank you for coming to us, and I'm glad your mum is sorted. Did you hear that in the news there, that music gig, Six Music? Who was it? Bicep. It just shows my age. I've never heard of them. Soak. And what was the other one? No, there was another one. I can't remember it. Point I'm making is I have never heard of any of these people. I'm kind of Celine Dion and Bette Midler. But anyway, that sounds like a good gig. I'm sure they're brilliant. I'm sure lots of younger people know exactly who they are, but I haven't a clue. Hannah, good morning, Hannah.
Morning.
Good morning. So your mum was on with us there before 10.
Yeah.
I'm sorry what's happened to you up in Dundonald.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Hannah. So you've got a little baby, 9-month-old?
Yeah, he is.
What's his name?
Cohen.
Cohen. So when you looked into your home, what did you see?
It was about 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. I actually heard rushing water and thought that, you know, maybe I've left the bathroom tap running. So went to check it out and then realised that there was water rushing in through our front door and we'd lost the bottom two steps of the stairs. So everything was just covered in sort of brown, murky, oily water.
Horrendous.
And yeah, everything downstairs is gone because even things that weren't touched by water are now damp from the moisture.
So just describe a little bit more for me. Were you able to walk into the house?
So we were already in the house.
What do you mean you were already in it?
We slept there overnight on Friday night and then the flooding came in on Saturday morning. So we were upstairs in bed whenever it flooded. So we didn't know until we could hear rushing water.
Oh my goodness. So you walked downstairs. What the living room, the kitchen? Just describe it to me.
It was just covered in brown water. At that stage it was ankle deep, but it got deeper than that as we were up and, you know, could see it and we're walking around in it. Everything was just everywhere. Basically, my son's toy box overturned, so all of his toys were just floating down this murky water. The floorboards had lifted up with water underneath them, so they were sort of floating, so you felt like you were walking a bit on jelly. It was just awful, basically.
Listen. Homes are a place of safety, isn't it? And it's our wee box and all of that. And your place is wrecked.
Yeah.
So
yeah, everything's destroyed, basically. I'm actually at the house today to try and salvage what I can, if I can.
And did the authorities have a heads up about this in terms of the street you're living in?
Well, we weren't given any heads up about it. The street is known to flood a bit, but when I say a bit, I mean I live at the sort of the top end of the street, and it's never flooded like this before. You know, I've lived in this street for 6 years, and it's never ever been this bad. I mean, we've had once or twice where there's been the tiniest trickle of water underneath the door, and I've been able to put a towel down, and that's caught it. You know, so it hasn't been bad enough that it's ever really affected us.
Mm-hmm. And
so it was a complete shock to see this.
And what type of help does or doesn't kick in?
Well, we've had the local church was fantastic. Crosspoint, they opened as a refuge centre.
Brilliant.
They were giving everyone tea, coffee, and they even gave my cat and dog food and water. They played with my wee one while we were trying to get things sorted. They were absolutely incredible.
Brilliant. Well, there was me asking earlier about churches, so there's an answer.
Yeah, they opened for 48 hours as if anyone didn't have a place to go initially.
Fantastic.
They were providing us blankets. The Red Cross were amazing as well. They came, they gave us soup, they gave us food. They even gave us care packs of toiletries as well each and foil blankets. And just, they were just incredible as well. Like, I can't thank all of them enough.
But that was for the 48-hour period over the weekend.
Yeah.
So here you are Monday morning.
Yeah.
Have any political representatives, East Belfast, up there, John Donald?
Well, Joanne Bunting from DUP and Gavin Robinson, they were there with us all day on Saturday.
Great.
They took our details, and I'm just waiting for a call from their office today because they're going to try and help us out as much as they can.
So Diane and Gavin were on the ground up there, were they, at the weekend?
Gavin and Joanne, yeah, they were on the ground, along with a few of their colleagues as well were on the ground. All from DUP, helping everyone, getting names, numbers of residents, basically just doing whatever they could. Like, they were very hands-on and even just providing hugs if we needed it, you know.
Well, there we again, praise where it's due. The praise coming from you, not me.
Yeah.
We ask about these local politicians. Do they connect? Do they care? And there they were at the weekend on the ground with you. What can they do at this stage? What help do you need now?
We need somewhere to live. I mean, looking at the damage, we've spoken to someone from sort of insurance claim people, and they were saying that things like this, like flooding and this, it's months before you're back in your home. And we rent, so I don't know what way it's going to work for us. So it's really just, we need somewhere to live. I mean, we're staying with my mum and dad at the minute, but, you know, there's five of us in a small house. You know, we can't, that's not sustainable to stay there for a long period of time.
You must be devastated.
Yeah, I don't think it's fully sunk in
and
yet.
Tired.
I haven't actually really cried about it yet.
I'm tired, yeah. Right? It must be exhausting, all of this.
I haven't slept since it happened.
Yeah. And just longer term in that street, I don't know what the authorities can and can't do, but, you don't want doing your house up again, landlords investing money again, for this to happen again.
Yeah, I don't know what is going to happen. They did infrastructure about a year ago or so, and it was meant to prevent flooding. And we got letters to say this should never happen, you know, there should never be any flooding, and it was worse than we've ever seen it.
Well, there needs to be a probe into that then, doesn't there?
Yeah, it's that. To be honest, that's not my priority at the minute. My priority is just getting somewhere to live. I can let the higher-ups deal with that.
Well, look, good luck, and thank you for talking to us this morning. And my heart goes out to you, Hannah. Thank you.
Thank you. All thank right. you very much.
All the best. It's Coal Island flooded as well, that I see. If any of you have been living down there and have been affected, 030 30 80 55 55. Any of you listening in Coal Island this morning, you can help me understand what happened where you were, and indeed elsewhere in Northern Ireland, if you've been affected by the flooding. Nolan at bbc.co.uk, 030 30 80 55 55. 12 minutes past 10. Next, this week, voters in the South will go to the polls. A lot of people looking at Sinn Féin. Results 4 years ago looked like Mary Lou MacDonald would become Ireland's first female Taoiseach. But it's been a difficult few months for Sinn Féin. The party's popularity has fallen dramatically, hitting rock bottom in the recent European and council elections when Sinn Féin took just 12% of the vote. So what's gone wrong? Well, I've been speaking to our political editor, Enda McClafferty. Let's find out.
Yes, and I think Sinn Féin will be pretty pleased as to where the polls suggest they're sitting right now in terms of the makeup of where we will be at the end of this election. We are very much in the same place, Stephen, we were after the last general election, with all the parties pretty closely bunched up together. This time it looks as if the latest opinion polls suggested that Sinn Féin sitting in and around 20%, Fianna Fáil in and around 21%, and Fine Gael in around 19%. If you look at where they were in 2020, it was Sinn Féin 24, Fianna Fáil 22, and Fine Gael 20. So I think those within Sinn Féin will be pleased at that, given, of course, the difficulties the party had and the run-up to this particular election.
What about Mary Lou MacDonald? Where is she? Is she still untouchable within the party? Is she the selling all of the messages and being put front and centre?
Well, we know it has been a challenging time for the Sinn Féin leader, not least, of course, dealing with those controversies in the run-up to the election, the fact that she had to apologise in the Dáil, not least over Michael McMonagall, of course, the former Sinn Féin press officer, and then she had her difficulties as well around the Irish senator, former Irish senator Niall O'Donnell, and then she lost the TD Brian Stanley as well. So you could not have had a more difficult and challenging run into this election than Mary Lou MacDonald had. That said, of course, we know that her strength is in campaigning. She's very good on the canvas trail, and that's seems to be reflected in how the party has managed to turn around its fortunes now and put itself in a much stronger position in terms of the negotiations, which we know will follow this election, because we are looking again at a coalition government in the South, as very much predicted. And I think the challenge for her will be finding a pathway to power, because in a sense, Stephen, what we're looking at now, we have an oven-ready government there in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. They're looking to poll numbers-wise to suggest that they're going to be in a pretty strong position post the election to form another government, and Sinn Féin is outside that circle in a sense, because Micheál Martin has made it very clear that he's not interested in going to government with Sinn Féin. So while Sinn Féin will do well likely in this election, Mary Lou MacDonald will be pleased. I think the difficulty will be in finding their way into government.
And the big issues in the South in this election, what are they?
Well, the familiar issues, housing, health, the cost of living crisis seems to have gone right to the top of the agenda this time round as well, which is no great surprise, because we know that whenever people go to the polls, they think about the issues that affect them most, and those are the key issues in the South and have been for some time. What's also interesting, Stephen, is the number of undecided voters. That was reflected in the polls again at the weekend. A third of voters in the Republic have yet to make up their mind as to which way they're going to go. We know from surveys after the last election that it was in the days that almost the majority of voters decided which way they were going to go. That's why these next 4 days are critical. We have a big debate tomorrow night with Mary Lou MacDonald, Simon Harris and Micheál Martin. That'll be key in terms of making that final pitch to voters to get things over the line for them. So there's a lot still to play for this in this election, Stephen, and I think this week might well shape where we're going to be, obviously, come polling day on Friday.
Enda, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Now, next, does Northern Ireland need a new flag? It's been reported by the Sunday Life that there will be calls for a new inclusive flag when the Commonwealth Games chiefs meet next week, this week, actually, at their AGM, with claims that both the current Union flag and Ulster banner are not representative of Northern Ireland athletes. The former MLA, Jim Wells. Morning, Jim.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And the Belfast Telegraph Night Editor, John Laverty. Good morning to you, John.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Do we need a new flag, John? And you know what happens when we talk about flags in this country? People go apoplectic.
Yeah, Stephen, you say, do we need a new flag? We don't have an old flag. We don't have a flag for Northern Ireland. We have literally a flag of convenience, the Ulster flag or the Ulster banner, which is being gonna, you know, which was representative of the old Northern Ireland government, which ended in 1973. So for 51 years, we've been using the Ulster banner as the Northern Ireland flag, which it isn't. We don't have one. So the question is, do we need a flag for Northern Ireland? Is yes, we do. We do need one. And this row over the...
What's wrong with the flags that we're currently using?
Well, the flag that we're currently using is not the Northern Ireland flag. It's a flag of convenience, which, you know, take the politics out of it for a second here, Stephen. It's a flag that has sort of been adopted as the Northern Ireland flag, but it is not the Northern Ireland flag, because Northern Ireland does not have a flag for its region. Obviously, there's the Union Jack for all, or the Union flag for all regions of the UK, but Northern Ireland itself does not have an official flag, and maybe it's time we got one, because 51 years later, maybe, I know things move very slowly when it comes to flags in Northern Ireland, but maybe it's time that we did move after 51 years and get an official flag for Northern Ireland that everybody accepts.
Jim?
Well, technically, that's not correct. The Ulster banner, as it was received royal assent, in 1924, so actually the banner of the flag is celebrating its centenary this year. It has been used by the government of Northern Ireland until 1972, and still used for the Northern Ireland football team, netball team, and indeed you'll notice that Rory McIlroy and other Northern Ireland golfers, when they play on the world stage, be it Ryder Cup or whatever, they also play under the Northern Ireland banner. And the question I'm asking here, Stephen, is what's this all about? Because as far as I know, this is not a controversy. I mean, great sportsmen like Paddy McGuigan and Hugh Russell and Paddy Barnes, Paddy Barnes, have played under this flag at the Commonwealth Games. Indeed, Paddy Barnes only boxed under the flag. He won a gold medal in the Commonwealth Games and then got an MBE for his services to sport. So as far as I know, nobody's actually complaining about this.
But hold on a minute. You've got officials, high-ranking officials at the Commonwealth Games. They've put forward a proposal to change the Ulster banner flag at future games. They're asking Stormont, look, could they come up with a flag? Could they get a flag designed which is appealing to everybody, Jim? What's wrong with that?
Well, they're trying to find a solution to something where there's no problem. I'm a Northern Ireland football fan, and great stars like Pat Jennings and Gerry Armstrong and Martin O'Neill excelled playing under that flag, and never was this issue raised. So why are they now stoking up the flames of controversy after 100 years by saying we want to change the flag? And Stephen, I wish you well, and I wish everybody well in trying to reach agreement on a new flag for Northern Ireland, because you know and I know how controversial and difficult an issue this is. So why not just leave it alone?
John Laverty?
Well, Jim will know as well as I do that in December 2021, Stormont's Commission on Flags, Identity, Culture and Tradition was published. So the issue over flags is obviously nothing new, but it was the official report on it, which cost £800,000, by the way, and took about 3 to 4 years to put together, was published. Nothing has happened in the last 3 years. So it's not a case of, you know, leave well alone, Jim. It's a case of this has been looked at, by a Stormont group, a Stormont appointed group over 3 years. since then, nothing has happened. So the issue about Northern Ireland needing a flag, an official flag. Now, I know the Ulster banner has been running for 100 years, but it has never been officially the flag of Northern Ireland. And that's why I believe Northern Ireland needs a new flag that will appeal to everybody. And it's and the Stormont Commission themselves, they need to look. They haven't met for a couple of years now. They need to look back on their own report, which was published in December 2021, and decide what they're going to do about this.
Well, Jim, we went to the Commonwealth Games in Northern Ireland body. Here's what they've told the Nolan Show. Commonwealth Games Northern Ireland is committed to having an inclusive environment where all members of our community feel welcomed as athletes, coaches, practitioners, volunteers, or members of staff. As part of routine games administration, each competing association is usually required to confirm their flag and anthem to the host organising committee around 4 months before the games begin. We therefore hope that the Northern Ireland Executive will come up with a flag solution before March, April 2026. We'd be happy to be involved in any discussions, but it is not our role to design a new flag. So this body has said, look, get it sorted. There's plenty of time. You've got to come up with it before April 26. Come up with a flag that is designed, that is appealing to everybody.
Well, the simple solution to that is for the executive to confirm that the Ulster banner, the Northern Ireland banner as we have it at the moment, is the official flag of Northern Ireland.
And you think, for example, Jim, the Shinners, Sinn Féin are going to support that, do you? You think they're going to say, yeah, that's what represents people who vote for them?
Well, unlikely, I would have thought.
But why are you suggesting it?
Well, I'm suggesting that up to now, it has not been a controversial issue. That those who have represented Northern Ireland, of all persuasions, have been more than happy to stand...
But you say up till now. I've literally just read you the statement from Commonwealth Games Northern Ireland to the Nolan Show, hoping that they're asking the Northern Ireland Executive to come up with a flag.
Yes, but what I think implicit in that is that maybe the Executive needs to formally confirm the flag of Northern Ireland. If that has been in abeyance since 1972, well, let's go back and confirm the
Northern
Ireland
banner. But for the Executive to do that, it would require Sinn Féin's buy-in, and I'm asking you again, do you expect Sinn Féin to buy into this?
No, I don't.
So therefore, why not come up with a new flag?
So if they have...
This is like...
The default situation is that they refuse to confirm we remain with the Ulster, the Northern Ireland banner as our official flag. But there's just no way.
Jim, it's not the official flag. That's the point.
Undoubtedly Sinn Féin would demand some element of the Irish tricolour in the flag, and that would be totally unacceptable to the unionist population and indeed many ordinary moderate people in the province. So if we can't reach agreement, just remain with the status quo and use a flag which has been perfectly happily accepted for 100 years.
And maybe, John Laverty, there is an argument. Let's not have another new argument over flags.
But then nobody will ever agree, Stephen. The proposal is to get something that everyone will agree on, and nobody is ever going to agree on the Ulster banner being used. Complete agreement on the Ulster banner being used as the official flag of Northern Ireland. Now, Jim has mentioned obviously people like Rory McIlroy and everybody have proudly held this flag up. Of course they have. I mean, but a lot of these people who hold this flag up are not actually aware that it's not the official flag of Northern Ireland because we don't have one. I mean, we had this conversation before, Stephen, about anthems. I think the same thing about an anthem. We need an official anthem for Northern Ireland everyone can accept. Okay. We need an official flag for Northern Ireland everyone will accept.
John, thank you. Jim Wells, thank you very much indeed. We can just see dropping on the news wires this morning, an 8-year-old girl and a man have been seriously injured in a shooting, according to the Metropolitan Police. They were taken to hospital. This shooting happened last night, around about 5:30. The little girl, the little 8-year-old, is in a stable condition with non-life-threatening injuries. 34-year-old man, his condition's unknown. 32-year-old woman taken to hospital. The police are appealing for witnesses, and I'm sure there'll be more on the BBC News website. The national website throughout the day on that. Next, the DUP MLA has raised concerns over the PSNI plans to build a new training college in Hollywood and if they can afford it. DUP MLA Peter Martin with us this morning. Morning, Peter.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. And John Burrows, former senior PSNI officer. Morning, John.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. So what are your concerns, Peter?
So, yeah, I asked the Justice Minister a question about this last week, and really I suppose my concerns are, and the question I asked was, does the PSNI have the capital budget to not only purchase this site, but then do something with it? And I suppose my fear is that perhaps they didn't have the money. It's not an issue that I was being critical of the police on. It was really, has the Justice Minister provided the PSNI with the adequate budget to do something with this site?
Why are they buying it? What are they going to do with it?
So they issued a statement in September that suggested it was going to be used for a new police college and training facility. But that's all I know. That's just public domain stuff in a statement that they issued. But I suppose as a North Down MLA, I'd like to see the site used for something and not just sit there as an asset that's not realised.
It's costing nearly 5 million quid to buy it.
That's right. It's costing 5 million to buy it. But I suppose the key thing, and John would agree, is that the capital required to do something with it will be significantly chunkier than the 5 million to buy it in the first place.
Is there a need, John Burrows, for a new centre?
Well, I think there is. I mean, look, John Boucher's said he wants to, bring around a world-class police service, and it's got many problems. One of it is it's a very aging infrastructure. I mean, its buildings are getting very old. It's actually 2004, 20 years ago, when they announced the first need for a new training college, and then it was going to be in Cookstown, and that was a whole debacle. So, 20 years on from saying we need a new training college, they now definitely need one. And it is, I've been in there many times. It's crumbling. It's not fit for purpose. And they need a world-class centre to train police officers for the challenges for the years ahead.
But why not build on the current site? Why not rebuild? What's the need for the new land?
I think there's a number of issues. I'm not sure it's limited simply to a training college. I mean, I don't know whether there's other opportunities if you're starting with a blank piece of paper to actually move other facilities into that and create other synergies. I mean, we've got a very old police headquarters, and theoretically, there's all kinds of options for bringing multiple things into that one site. We don't know. What I would say to you is the police have spent millions, and they were given £20 million way back whenever the Cookstown plan was shelved, the refurb. But refurb's really difficult. You're putting its finger in a dike, and you've always got contractors in. You're always replacing stuff. And, of course, you can't move everybody out, because you've got continual need for a building. So it's actually easier to have your existing building, build something fresh and new, and actually have a real vision for policing going forward.
Well, Peter, are you hearing any whispers about what more they might want to do with this beyond the training centre?
No, not that I'm aware of, Stephen. That's just what was in the public domain. John's right. There's an £80 million police training centre announced in February 2004 in Desert Crete. I mean, that whole process was a debacle. They never actually, police never moved to it. And it rumbled on for, I think, about 17 years. I'm not sure it's even still built. So I suppose what the ideas might be signed. I wanted to ensure, and the Justice Minister gave me no comfort. I mean, she didn't even answer the question as to whether or not the PSNI actually have the capital to do something with it, because my hope is that it would bring, whatever's done with it would bring either jobs or construction in the North Down, but there is no clarity over it at the moment.
Well, the PSNI themselves, they're using lots of big words. The site is proposed as a key enabler in wider Belfast rationalisation and aligns to a state strategic asset plan. What does this mean? That includes provision for future delivery, here we go, of a new police college and training facility for the PSNI, proposed development of the site being subject to business case and future funding approval. We continue to undertake significant engagement with various key stakeholders, including local residents. Do any residents know what's going on? To discuss all the potential opportunities and benefits of any future development. In other words, they're not telling us exactly what they intend to do there. Peter, thank you very much. John, thank you. That's it from the Nolan Show for today. Sure, we kicked off this week. We'll be with you every day, Monday to Friday at 9 o'clock. Have a good day, everyone. We'll see you back here at 9 o'clock in the morning. And thank you for listening.
The biggest biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.